Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B.
Today's guest is Rich Anderson, 25 years of combination experience, a lieutenant with San Antonio Fire Department on Engine 4. Rich always had the notion he wanted to be a firefighter. Pre-backdraft, the long coat, hip boots, and jeans were always etched in his mind. When the time came for Rich to apply, he had to go up against thousands. But with hard work and studying, Rich's dreams came true. I absolutely loved the conversation between Rich and I on this interview. One of the takeaways, if you're a company officer, is you best believe others are watching everything you do. You can't just talk about it. You have to be about it. With that, I present Rich Anderson.
Hey, Danny. Thank you for having me on today. Before we jump right in and start talking shop, I wanted to give a couple shout-outs real quick, if that's cool. First to my family, my beautiful wife, Marnie, and my awesome kids, Jet and Delilah. You guys are my why. Thank you for being so supportive of me in this job. And to my crew at Fours, y'all are the best. You know that. I appreciate you, and thank you for helping me live my dream out every shift.
My name's Rich Anderson. I'm a lieutenant with the San Antonio Fire Department. I've been with the fire department for 24 years. And how I got into the fire service was I grew up in New England, in Massachusetts, the small town of Braintree. It was a small town. It's bigger now. It's about 10 miles outside of Boston on the South Shore. I grew up always wanting to be a firefighter. They were all around me. The fire service culture up in New England is as strong as it gets. The history, the brotherhood, all of that has always been around me. I had civil service in my family, but they were all cops. I didn't have any fire service background whatsoever. So I was always interested in it. My mom gave me a picture that I drew of a fire truck when I was about 4 years old. And it's been with me ever since. But when I was young, it's kind of funny. I always looked at firefighters larger than life. You know, I grew up in like the pre-backdraft era. I'm a little bit older. I turned 50 this year, so I have a lot of nostalgia for the fire service. But the firefighters I grew up with looked like backdraft. Leather helmets, roll-up boots, long coats, you know, maybe not some BAs. They rolled up on tiller trucks, you know, just the old school fire service, you know, guys in jeans and T-shirts. Larger than life characters. So that's what I grew up on. And I always wanted to be one, but it always felt like something that somebody else got to do, you know, somebody who was bigger, tougher, had their act together, braver, you know, like you had to be a superhero to be a firefighter. So I always wanted to do it, but sometimes I had doubts. Like in high school, I thought about other options. Like at one point I thought I was going to go to college for marine biology. So growing up on the ocean, but it always came back to the fire service. I got my EMT from Northeastern. And once I got out of high school and I wound up going to college up at Southern Maine Tech, I think it's Southern Maine Community College now in South Portland in Maine. And that was great. That was my first chance getting to really be around firefighters, because a lot of guys in my dormitory were firefighters or volleys back in their hometowns. So it was interesting talking to them because I really didn't know the culture at all. I also joined the Air National Guard because I grew up with my grandfather as my hero. He was a World War II vet, military policeman. And he served all the way from Africa up through Italy, all the way into Belgium and France. So he went all the way through World War II. He was my hero. So through the course of, I joined the military, I went in the Air Force to be a cop. And that brought me to San Antonio. Long story short, I looked around, I loved it. And I always thought about moving here. But I started testing in New England and in the mid 90s, getting on a civil service job, police or fire, was almost impossible. It was, everybody was testing. You had to have a lot of things going for you, and I didn't have any of them going for me. I was just another guy. There was a million of guys just like me. But I got to come back to San Antonio to go through the Security Police Academy. And while I was down here, I looked around some more, and I wound up moving to Texas. I went home and I was like, I'm out. I need to branch out. And it was hard to leave New England. I get homesick for it, but Texas has been very, very good to me. So I came down and I tested for San Antonio. I didn't do as well as I would have hoped. I was overwhelmed. I walked in and there was over 4,000 people in the convention center for a class of 40. So yeah. So I was overwhelmed. I'd never seen a test that big. There was people lined up down the block. So anyways, I got my score. It wasn't what I hoped it would be. It was pretty good. But I went right down and I signed up for the local fire academy at the college. Because I was like, I got to get certified somewhere so I can start working. And while I was in the college fire academy, I met some San Antonio firefighters that were teachers. You know, they were instructors at the academy. And they asked me about my score and I told them. And they were like, oh, you're probably going to get called, you know, to continue in the process. And I was like, no way. Because I scored an 85 out of 100, which in Massachusetts will get you exactly nothing. But it was the, I guess every few years they would rotate the test. As scores would creep up, in order to separate them out again, they would put out a new test to kind of spread the scores out. And I remember there was a ton of reading on my test. There'd be like a page and a half of reading for like two or three questions. So it took a long time. And I was decent at taking tests. I would read the questions first and then go back through the reading to pick out the questions and not actually do the reading. And we got to the end of the, near the end of the test. And I was like, okay, I'm done. Sat down in my seat and they're like, okay, you guys have 15 minutes left. And people started scrambling and they're just checking anything off the page. So that's what happened is I got in cause I got lucky. Cause a lot of people just ran out of time on the test. Mm-hmm. So I took that as a good sign. I finished out the rest of the process. I was overprepared for everything. Showed up to every appointment like an hour early, wore a suit to everything. Like I way overdid it. We were doing the Cooper's test back then for a physical exam, which was push-ups, sit-ups, timed runs, sit and reach, things like that. I did that test every day on my own so that I could do as well as I possibly could on it. And I made it in, which was crazy. I finished the College Fire Academy in December of 2000. And I started in San Antonio in February of 2001, which was, I was thrilled to be starting my career. And at the same time, I was like, oh no, I was a year straight of being in a fire academy. Mm-hmm. But I got on the job and went through the academy, no problems. It came out the other end and I wanted to go to Station 8 out on the west side. At the time, that was the place to be. It's a low income, primarily Hispanic area in San Antonio, plenty of fire duty over there, great culture in that firehouse. There was a captain over there, Captain Joe, who was known for training his rookies really well. So I studied real hard on our exit exam, got a tiny bit of seniority in my class and was able to go there. I got over to 8s and it was everything I hoped it would be. We were making fires of all different kinds. We were up all night. Getting agitated by the crew, messing up left and right. And then my details were to truck one, which was downtown right behind the Alamo. And that was a tiller. So I'm riding at 8s fighting fire and I'm detailing to ones to the tiller. It was everything I hoped it could be, right? Mm-hmm. But all good things come to an end. Thanks a lot, Bin Laden. 4 weeks into my probation, September 11th happens. So like everyone else, I was home. It was my full day off. I woke up. I'm watching the first tower had just been hit. And I'm just blown away. I'm like, how are they ever going to put that fire out? I knew nothing about high-rise firefighting. I was barely learning how to do shotgun shacks on the west side. So I'm looking at this, 100-story tower burning, and then the second plane hit. And then my heart just sank. I knew what was going on. I knew what was going to happen next. And so I made it about another 10 days in the fire department. And then the military called me up. My commander called me. He's like, report to the ready room, bring your bags. You're going to be deployed. So that was the end of my probationary year. I wound up being placed on Title 12 active duty for a year. They sent us up to North Texas for a while to backfill because all their cops went overseas right away. And then we got rotated out in January and we were sent over to the Middle East. So that's how I spent my probationary year. I came back after my year. I wound up ETSing. It was right at the end of my service, and they were either going to stop loss me and keep me indefinitely or let me get out. So I had a short window to get out, and I was ready to go back to being a firefighter. So I came back, and I called up, reported back to work, and was like, Mike, do I go back to eights? And they were like, oh, no, brother. You've been assigned to Engine 31. I was like, I don't even know where that is. They're like, well, you're going to the north side. So I went up to Engine 31. I had a really great captain there. It took me under his wing. I spent a few, about a year and a half out there at Engine 31, learning how to fight apartment fires and things like that. Totally different feel from the west side. And then out of nowhere, he told me, he was like, hey, I'm leaving the company. They're going to put a truck company on at this station that was farther north, like almost in the boondocks. It was Station 46. Slow station, but they were going to put a ladder company out there because the area was growing tremendously. So he was like, hey, I want you to come out there with me. You can learn how to be on the truck. And I was like, I don't want to go out there. It's slow. And he's like, just come with me. So I was like, well, to make him happy, I put in on the transfer list. I had no seniority. I did not think I would get it. Well, I got it. So, the moral of my whole story here, by the end of this podcast, will be like everything in your career happens for a reason, and you'll appreciate it all as you go farther on. So, I went to this slow station. The guys were cool. I wasn't learning a whole lot. I felt myself backsliding. I was starting to commit all of the firefighter sins, I looked the part riding down the street in this big shiny truck. I had the uniform. It was a nice area. Everyone was very, very nice to us. Wasn't getting too many fires. Was getting out of shape. You know how it goes. I mean, you go to a slow station, and if you're not super motivated and disciplined, you can start to backslide. That was happening to me. So I saw some news footage from us at a fire, and we're standing by the back of the rig, and we weren't doing anything at the time, just rehabbing. And I just looked like I'm looking at myself on this video. I'm like, I don't even belong there. I don't even look like a firefighter. I just looked lost. So I thought, oh, man, how can I get my career refocused? So I was like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll apply for the rescue company. They'll fix me up, right? They'll get me on the right path. So I interviewed with them. They didn't take me. They were very nice, but of course they weren't going to take me. I interviewed again. They didn't take me. And then finally the captain took me aside, and he was very cool with me. He was like, Rich, you seem like a good dude. You seem like you really love the job and you want to get better. He's like, but you're trying to come to the rescue from this really slow ladder company with no experience. I was like, got it. I got it. He's like, transfer somewhere busier, get some time and experience, get some fires under your belt, find a mentor, come back to us down the road. So I did. I transferred over to Truck 40 at the next possible, availability. At the time, they were running a lot of calls. They were one of the enhanced rescue trucks of the city. They had a little more tools, a little more equipment than some of the other truck companies. Went to a lot of extrications. Went to some good apartment fires, some good house fires. I found a good guy named Chuck to follow around, and he was very patient with me and showed me the ropes. It was like I was starting all over again. I went out and got my rope tech on my own, and kept applying for rescue, just kept showing up. And then finally one day they took pity on me and took a chance on me. And they were like, okay, you're going to get a spot. So I came down there in the fall of 2006 to rescue 11. And man, I start there. That's where my career actually started, was from that point on. Who I am today as a firefighter started with those guys. They sat me down the first day and they were like, you're not going to be an all-star here just because you remember your traffic vest or you always have a pen when the captain needs one. They're like, everyone here is better than you. And you're going to learn to appreciate that because they're going to make you better if you can keep up. And then they just beat on me for 6 months straight. It was constant. I really learned how to train there. They taught me how to train all day, every day. Didn't matter the weather, hot, cold, middle of the night drills at like 3 a.m. No sympathy. They do not do sympathy over there. They just, you're going to learn. But after 6 months, you get certified. And in San Antonio, the rescue companies do everything. There's two companies now. At the time, there was just the one. But you do rope, you do trench, confined space, extrication, elevators, building collapse, everything. RIT stuff at second alarms. They go to all multiple alarms. And as you learn all these things and get certified, they immediately want you to start teaching it, because their philosophy is there's no way you can know this stuff unless you can teach it. So I got a lot of knowledge just poured into me very quickly, and a lot of tough love. I almost quit once, and it was like they knew that was going to happen too. One of my buddies, James, called me up. We had a really tough shift. The lieutenant and I weren't getting along. I couldn't seem to understand him. He seemed frustrated with me. I was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to make it. I went home, my phone rang, and James called me and he was like, getting ready to quit, aren't you? And I was like, man, I was kind of thinking about it. He's like, don't do it. You're almost there. Everyone goes through this. Show the guys that you're not a quitter. Keep coming back. Keep doing it. You're almost there. As soon as you're certified, everything changes. I went back, finished out my training. We had a final scenario, myself and the other guy that was getting trained, that was 7 hours long, that involved ropes, breaching and breaking, victim recovery, search cameras, all these things. Finished out, got certified. They give you your golden carabiner, you know, that you put on your belt so everyone can agitate you for the rest of your life. And that's it. Then you're in, you know. The training, of course, does not stop there. That's just the beginning. Then all the real work starts. But that culture that they had there, I always appreciated. The brotherhood that they had there, I always appreciated. And what they poured into me really changed my career, and I'll always be grateful for that. So I spent 4 years at 11s, and then my twins were about to be born right at the same time. They were going to start a second rescue company in the city on the north side, 51s. And I took the opportunity to go up there. I wanted to be a part of getting that team off the ground and continuing the culture that 11s had to 51s. I knew some things would change, some things would be, you know, different, but I wanted the roots, you know, to be the same. So I got to do that. My twins were born. And so life changed for me there. And so they kept me busy at work. My twins kept me busy at home. And then about 4 years into being at 51s, you know, I was starting to get a little bit older. I was pushing 40 years old. I started thinking about studying for engineer. And it just felt like time. It felt like time. At the time, they were thinking about converting one of the firefighter positions at rescue to a driver position for the heavy rescue. How the teams work is at each station, rescue station. There's an engine, a truck, and the heavy rescue. There's four on the engine, four on the truck, two on the heavy rescue, and they roll out just in whatever complement they see fit for the run. So they were going to convert one of those firefighter spots to be a full-time driver for the heavy rescue. So I thought, man, if I study and promote, my spot will convert to an engineer spot, and then maybe I can compete for that spot. It wound up not happening, of course. The city pulled the plug on it when I was, you know, several rounds into the study books. And I made the decision at that point. I was like, well, I've already come this far. I'm going to go ahead and promote or try to promote. So I studied. I did well on the engineer's exam. I got promoted with, I had about 13 and some change on the tailboard when I finally made engineer. And how it works in San Antonio is the majority of our engineers will get pulled into the EMS division, sent through paramedic training, and then you're on the box, normally for about 3 years. Until you can either apply to come out of EMS or you promote again. And it's a blessing and a curse. One of our biggest assets, I think, in San Antonio is that our firefighters don't ever have to touch the box if they don't want to. If you want to be on the back, you're on the back, and you are on your apparatus. We don't rotate apparatus. If you're assigned to an engine, you're on that engine. If you're on the truck, you're on that truck. Every shift, you don't ever have to worry about getting on the ambulance, which I think is great. You pay your penance when you make engineer because you're probably going to be in EMS for a few years. And it can be tough if you want to go to fires, because you won't have the opportunity to do that. Our medics don't fight fire. But our medicine is very advanced in San Antonio. It's a world-class EMS system. It's very well supported. It's very well led. You'll do a lot of medicine, you know, you'll push a lot of drugs. You'll use the scalpel quite a bit. Our doctors are very forward thinking. So you need to concentrate on that. And in being an EMS in San Antonio, you're going to have the opportunity to concentrate on that because you don't have to worry about fire. They take that right off your plate. Anyways, I got to go over to station number 9 from my time in EMS. I was on Medic 9. I had a couple of really great partners. And 9's is over on the east side, which is also low income. And at the time, it's starting to be gentrified now, and they're doing a nice job of making a lot of it really nice. It's a good historic area. But at the years I was there, it was very rough, gang violence-wise, and just a rough neighborhood. You could describe it with the G word if you wanted to. But I got a lot of great experience there. All the dudes over at 9's were really cool. It was a really great historic firehouse. They call it the Animal House over there. The place was built back in 1913. Cool place to work, even on the ambulance. I did my 3 years over there. I took a shot at going back to rescue as an engineer. Competition for that was very rough. And you got to be the right guy for the right crew at the right time. Mm. I wasn't that guy. So I went all in on studying for promotion because I was ready to go back to fight fire. I was lucky during my time in EMS. I was still a member of the Fools. I was a member of the Alamo Area Fools chapter, and they kept me plugged in to the fire side of things. So I never really lost touch. Still got to train, keep up with a lot of things in the fire service. So I studied for about a year. I hit the books hard because making lieutenant is a pretty steep climb down here. Got lucky, had a good test day, and I got promoted to engineer. I'm sorry, lieutenant, made lieutenant. And bounced around a little bit at first for a few months, and then I got a call from one of my friends, and he was like, hey, there's going to be a spot downtown at Fours. You probably won't get it. You don't have any seniority, but they got a good crew down there. They just lost their lieutenant. He went over to Hazmat, and he's a super good guy, great leader. And so they're kind of heartbroken he left, but, you know, they need somebody good. He's like, you should throw your name in the hat. And I was like, well, I'll try. I coming downtown sounded great to me. So I came down and I met the guys, and they were like, yeah, I think they were kind of feeling me out. Like, who is this dude? But I was like, hey, I'll come down. I'll do the best I can. I'm familiar with downtown, but long story short, I hadn't been on an engine in a long, long time. The majority of my tailboard time, I'd been on a truck. I went from, you know, from my short time in engine 31, I went from truck 46 to truck 40 to truck 11 to truck 51. So coming downtown and being on an engine was very intimidating for me. I'd say my engine skills were basic at best. And by basic, I mean weak. But they were like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, put in. So I put in. There was some last minute juggling on the transfer list, and I wound up getting the spot. I came down to fours. I've been there ever since. So seven plus years down at fours. There's been a lot of changes, but it's a wonderful, wonderful place to work. Great, great crews down there. We're surrounded by great companies. My chain of command has been awesome my whole time, and we'll get into that a little bit. But yeah, that's my very long story about how I went through the past 24 years in San Antonio.
Okay. No, I loved hearing it, man. I definitely have some questions for you. what's your take on, because like I had Manny the Barbarian a while back, and uh-huh. He mentioned how when you go for engineer, you're pretty much like kicked out of the fire side and you run the EMS side. Pros and cons to everything. What were your pros? What are your cons when it comes to how SAFD does things?
Well, like I said, the pro is that as a firefighter, as a tailboard, you don't have to worry about that box. And there is almost nowhere down here that if you go to a fire department, you know, as a tailboarder, that you're not going to be on the ambulance in some capacity. Even right. Small departments or the large metro departments, you're going to do a lot of time on the box. And in San Antonio, you just don't. If you come and you're a tailboarder, you're riding tailboard. And I don't think we appreciate that enough. I think, right. I think if some guys came from other departments, they would appreciate what a blessing it is to just come and be a firefighter. You're still going to make a ton of medical runs, you know, first responder. That's everybody, right? But you don't have to worry about that whole other world of transporting and all that other stuff until later in your career, when honestly, you might be more ready for it, you know? Mm-hmm. I know there's smaller agencies all around us in the county, and they have their own transports, and they have a lot of aggressive protocols too, and they get after it. And honestly, I'm amazed they can do both. I don't know how you concentrate so hard at both, because both are, it's two totally different career fields, two totally different skill sets, and they meet in some areas, but that's just a lot to keep up with. So anyways, yeah, if you're a tailboarder, that's all you got to do is fight fire, and you should be taking that time to really do your best at fighting fire and enjoying that. And when you make engineer in San Antonio, you should just know that you're going to probably go to EMS. Like probably 90% of the dudes get pulled into EMS, dudes and women, everybody. That's Everyone gets pulled in. So you should just mentally prepare yourself for that. Like if you're taking the engineer's exam, you should just figure like, I'm probably going to EMS. And then take advantage of all it has to offer. In fire, you work a 24-48 schedule straight. In EMS, you work a 24-72. They have four shifts instead of three. Because the call volume is so high, they need you to be able to get your rest in between, you know? Now, of course, nowadays, fire is getting so busy that there's a lot of people pushing for the 24-72 in fire, which I wish we could do, because the call volume is so much higher now than it was, you know, when I was a tailboarder. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the plus and the minus, right? You get your time on the back to concentrate in fire. You're kind of forced to concentrate on your medicine during your engineer years. But I think you know, is it frustrating to spend several years not fighting fire? Yes. If you're into the job firefighting wise, that's rough. But if you look at it from the perspective of, you know, hey, I have 3 years here to really concentrate on getting good at my medicine and enjoying some more time off, you know, I think those are pros as well.
Okay.
Frustrating in the middle of the night when you roll up first due to a fire and there's nothing you can do with it, you know, try to help the engine catch the hydrant and get your hand slapped, but it is what it is. That's
Right.
our system, you know.
Okay. And 3 years max, or could it be less than 3 years?
So it's changing now. For a long time, there's a lot of vacancy in the EMS division, and now from what I hear, it's pretty full. So that time being mandated in there, I think is shortening. But on average, it's about 3 years before you could start putting in a letter to get out. And that kind of coincides with the time where you're studying for promotion to lieutenant anyways. So we'll just throw 3 years at it, you know. Some people just they fall in love with the EMS side and they choose to stay. They like the overtime. They like the schedule, the flexibility, you know, vacation and everything. Maybe that lines up with their family life, and then they just choose to stay. Some people really, really love it. And others, you know, that are like me, it wasn't for me long term. I enjoyed my time as best I could. My partners helped tremendously with that. I had some crazy partners, and we were just getting into whatever. But, you know, it wasn't for me. I wanted to come back to the fire truck as soon as I could. So.
Okay. And it just sounds like, even though it's the same organization, two different worlds, two different set schedules, two different ways of doing things. It's fascinating to hear that.
It is, and it can be, I mean, I won't lie, it can be a little bit lonely in EMS. They refer themselves as a redheaded stepchild sometimes, you know. And you could be in the same room with the fire company and you're all in the same uniform and you know these guys and you fought fire with them, but you're a little bit on the outside once you're in EMS, you know, because you've got that other role to fulfill. Which you if you haven't been in EMS, you know, then you don't quite understand what it is like to be in that role, you know. But it's just a part of your career path in San Antonio. It's just how we do it. Everybody's got their things, and in San Antonio, that's ours. So
Okay. And you'd mentioned a scalpel. So to me, I'm thinking that's like when you get to the hospital setting, surgeons and doctors, but apparently you can do that there.
they do some crazy medicine down here. When I say it's advanced, it is advanced. The doctors down here have us doing, and I've done four crikes myself.
No shit.
Yes, it just worked out that way. And
Wow.
then I assisted, you know, on a fifth. And the first time we did it, like I said, I had EMS partners that were down for everything. The first time we did it, we had this poor lady that. She had cancer and she had masses in her throat that were just getting this edema and she couldn't breathe and it was time to get her to the hospital and we could not get a patent airway on her. And my partner and I had been practicing and put together a kit and everything and I just looked at him. I was like, Mike, this is the one. And he just hands me a scalpel. He didn't say anything. He just handed me a scalpel. He was like, do it. Okay, so we did it. And the hardest part of the whole skill was just committing to make the cut. Once you commit to it, there's no turning back and it was fine. And then it just, I don't know, I fell into a few more of those situations over a few years, you know, twice coming off the fire truck after I'd been promoted as a lieutenant. No,
Damn.
three times now. I'm sorry, it's three times now off the fire truck where I've wound up with a scalpel in my hand. And it's not just, you know, surgical airways for blunt trauma arrest and stuff. They want us to, you know, decompress the chest and do finger thoracostomies and things like that. All of that is in our playbook. So
Damn.
it is crazy, right? Like if you'd
Right.
have told me when I came out of the fire academy, you know, in 01, hey, someday you're going to get off the fire truck with a scalpel to do medicine, I'd be like, you're get out of here. Get out of here. But no, that's how it is. Does it happen every day, everywhere? No. Does it happen often? Yeah, a lot more often than you would think.
Okay. And then I'm assuming, of course, Because you mentioned it, once you got back on the truck, even though you're a lieutenant, you're still able to utilize those skills.
Yes. We have a lot of paramedics in fire now, a lot of paramedics. So most of our, all of our apparatus, engines, ladders, everything, we have a full complement of ALS equipment. We all have cardiac monitors. So as long as there is a paramedic on there, that's an ALS capable company. And that's the vast majority across the city now. How it used to be back in the day was, you'd come out of the EMS division and the city wouldn't necessarily support you keeping your paramedic. They didn't want you to lose it, but they didn't really kick in anything to help you keep it. Now they very much get you your CE and take care of all your credentialing and everything so that you can maintain your paramedic, because they want ALS fire units, as many as possible. So we've got a tremendous amount of paramedics in San Antonio. So
That's
that's how the
awesome.
system rolls. Yeah, it's very cool. If somebody gets sick in San Antonio, like, they really are in good hands. And I didn't want this podcast to be all about EMS, but here we are. Sorry, everybody.
No. Listen, like, it's a different perspective, because in my world where I'm at, we're all first responders, okay? We're all EMT basics. And so with that skill, because from when I started to where we are now, we are able to give medicines now that we couldn't before. The only way we could do it is if, like, EMS was on scene. But now, as you said, with times and how things are changing, our services are also evolving. Granted, the paramedic side, the county provides that, and fire trucks, we get there usually 9 times out of 10, we get there first, so we're able to make a difference. But it is, to me at least, it is like amazing to hear how one organization is doing these, like, we firefighters love aggressive tactics when it comes to the fire side, but you guys definitely have aggressive tactics when it comes to EMS.
Yes, very much so. And what that leads to is, now that I'm back in fire, I would like to think I'm part of trying to help my department, along with a lot of other people, with making our firefighting as cutting edge as our EMS, And firefighting, being cutting edge in firefighting, is almost like going backwards, right? We're all going back to the basics now. We have been for this whole like resurrection, renaissance period of the engine company. That's what, 7, 8 years in the making now. And the truck culture as well. In San Antonio, I'd like to be a part of, with a lot of other hard charging officers and crews out there, and some key members of our upper echelons, really trying to bring our firefighting back to where it's on par with where our EMS is, I think, like every other, fire service agency over the past course of my career, and even before that, probably the generation before that, I think there's been a lot of mission creep. We went from being firefighters to, I'll just give you the San Antonio timeline. We were firefighters, then we started taking on EMS in the 70s, and then hazmat in the 80s, rescue in the 90s. In the 2000s, we got into disaster response, terrorism. Then you get into shelters after the hurricanes. We took in a lot of people from Katrina and Rita and the hurricanes. A lot of people from the Gulf Coast came here, so we took on shelter management, and then there's COVID and mobile integrated health. We have a robust MIH program where it's like community paramedicine. So you just see this, the envelope of services we provide has become so big. I feel like firefighting has just kind of been, like, not pushed to the wayside, but it seems like, everyone expects, like, okay, we've got that. Now let's take on all of these other things. But I think it comes at a cost, So I think we're in the process in our city of trying to push firefighting back to the forefront of what we do, in my opinion, anyways. So it's exciting to be a part of that. It is frustrating to be a part of that. It is hard to make change stick in a 1800 member department. So, yeah, that's where we're at these days. That's what keeps us busy.
No, I get it. And it definitely resounded. You said it's hard to make change stick with 1800 personnel. It's hard when you got 120. Like, I mean,
Oh,
I know
yeah.
some people say the smaller the organization, the better. I can tell you, at least from my experiences, it's a tough sell. Like, because firefighters are stuck. They don't want change. They want change, but then they don't want change. And it's like, well, where are we? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, exactly. Change anywhere is hard, you know. Back one of the many hats I threw into the ring when I came back to the fireside is I got involved with the tool and equipment committee. And a few years ago, our hose contract was up. The supplier that we had, for whatever reason, we weren't going to be going with them anymore. I don't know if it was a logistical issue or whatever. But they were looking for somebody to take over testing, evaluating, recommending of new attack packages. So I'd been diving since I'd gotten back on an engine, diving hard into research, everything I could find. You know, I was on engine company resurrection every day, trying to learn stuff. Through the fools, I was able to, you know, start talking to Dennis Laguerre, who is a tremendous resource for me. So I had a lot of thoughts and ideas in seeing what other people in the fire service were doing, some that never went away from it and some that were going back to it. So I told him, I'll take the lead on the hose and nozzles, but here's where I'm going with it, just, you know, full transparency. So I want low pressure hose. I want smooth bores back on our apparatus. Not 100%, but I want the option for all hand lines to have a smooth bore, for a lot of different reasons. You know, I saw issues with improperly pumped hand lines because we had automatic nozzles that would cover for it. You know, whether it was too hot or too light, you know, your stream always looked great, and we didn't have the education to know, I think, what exactly we were flowing. We're also just the physicality of the people that get hired these days is the recruits don't look the same as they did, you know, as when I came in. When I came in, almost everybody in my recruit class was from, you know, city service or the military, you know, and they're all big farm guys or, you know, welders or whatever. And now we have people that are coming. This is their first, you know, civil service job, and they're coming from being a valet, or they're in tech, or they're in accounting. So the physicality is different. So I think it's not fair to them to recruit them into the job and then put them on equipment that just does not support that. You know, number one, it's not the greatest for fire attack, I think, in today's fuel packages, but to put them on something that's way over pumped, that it's going to be hard for them to handle, that lies to them like an automatic nozzle will, you know, and they're like, I'm putting water on this fire. Why isn't it going out? So I love the way this fire service went. The hose technology got better to allow us to bring things like smooth bores or low pressure, fixed flow, fog nozzles back. And now these firefighters of different sizes can flow that line. You know, once they get their technique down, they can flow and move. They can flow all day on the 2.5. We don't need to stack three or four people on a hose line anymore, you know? But that was the way that I went with that, with our hose and nozzles. I had a lot of help. I had a lot of help from the committee. I had a lot of help from the administration. It was way smoother than I thought it was going to be. I thought I was going to get a lot more resistance, but I really didn't. You know, we worked through the logistics of it and the reasoning behind what we were doing. And like you said, there are people out there that don't like change, no matter what it is. It could be what you're proposing, when you're proposing it, or even just who you are. You know, they're like, I don't like that idea because you came up with it. Well, fair enough, but Yeah, so change is tough in any organization. I envy the smaller departments that, have, you can watch like The Colony, like their amazing culture that they have, and they seem like they have such a tight control over it,
Right.
over every aspect of it. Like, this is what we will do, and this is the characteristics that we want, that we are going to stand by. And if you work for a large metropolitan organization, you just sit there and you're just like, wow, I can barely control my own firehouse.
That's a fact. That's a fact. All right. So when it comes to leadership, you decided to finally promote to lieutenant and you were able to achieve that. So it's a two-part question. What does a leader look like to you? What does leadership look like to you, and what kind of leader did you want to be?
Leadership to me, I had some really great officers coming up, and they I tried to pick out some of their best qualities, and the best qualities that they had is that they trusted their people, they motivated their people, but they held them accountable. They set very high standards, but then they themselves were the ones demonstrating that standard, so you wanted to live up to what they were doing. So it wasn't like they weren't pushing you, they were pulling you. They were pulling you forward. So that's what I wanted to be as a leader, as an officer. I wanted to be somebody that was out in front, leading my people forward, right? Or when the time was right, pushing them to the front and letting them make decisions, letting them set the goals, helping them achieve their goals. None of us can do it alone. Whether your career is what you want or not what you want, you have a huge responsibility in how your career goes. But the people around, you need good people around you, because they're going to set kind of the framework for how your career goes. So that's what I look for. Servant leadership, is very high on my list of characteristics. I really believe in putting the company first. My job is, in my crew, is to just watch out for them, give them what they need. They do all the work. They really do. I joke all the time that I just push buttons and talk on the radio. And I feel like a lot of times I get too much credit for that, for the awesome work that they've done, not just my current crews, but the crews that have come before them. I've been through several different variations during my time at Fours. All amazing, motivated people. But they do all the work. So my job is to give them opportunities as much as possible to do good work. I try to set expectations, and then I help them meet them. Very quickly, they exceed them. And then, through crew rotation, we bring in the next person, or we're real big. We pride ourselves on taking probationary firefighters on a lot. In San Antonio, a firefighter comes out of the academy, and for their first 10 shifts, they're going to put them out of firehouse. And sometimes this changes, but as a general rule, they'll put them in one place for their first 10 shifts, so they have some consistency before they rotate through their battalion and then around the city for the rest of their 6-month probation. And we get somebody for their first 10 shifts. We put everything we've got into them. It's almost like that same fire hose of knowledge that I got when I got to the rescue company. We do that to them. We just pour into them everything we've got, so that after 10 shifts, they can confidently go on to that next firehouse and be like, hey, I've got some skills, some real world experience in my back pocket to start drawing from. And I have a better understanding of the culture. And I've got a company that I can call at any time if I struggle from here on out, or have questions or whatever. I can always call back to this officer and this crew, and they're going to help me out. So that's what I'm looking for
Okay.
out of a leader.
Okay. And definitely to have that mindset, it's important to have a mentor, right? And I know a lot of firefighters I talk to don't want to be like, well, no, don't call me a mentor, but you honestly learn from good and bad officers to form the officer if you are one today, moving forward.
Yes. I have had great mentors, even though I didn't know that they were my mentors. Like looking back, I was like, geez, I really learned a lot from that guy because I find myself doing things now that I made fun of him, for doing them back then. But now I completely understand, and I'm on board with it. And then I have former leaders, mentors now that I look to above me and at my same rank, and even at ranks lower than lieutenant. There's people at all ranks that you just look at their personalities and how they lead those around them, and there's a lot to be inspired by. There's a lot of selfless people in the fire service, and you can pick them out if you're looking for it. You can just pick them out. You just watch the way that people follow them or pay attention, or when they speak, you look and see who's listening, who is actively listening. And those are the people that, you start picking up on and picking up the traits that you want,
Okay. It sounded like, no, I don't want to say it sound like, it sounds like for sure when you were at 11s, they had that good company culture. One thing that I like that I hear other bigger departments do is, like, for instance, you mentioned how you have 6 months to complete and learn all the portions and skills of the rescue, and then at the end, you had a 7-hour test. When I went to DC and rode the house I was riding at, they had a rescue assigned there, and they call it anytime they get a member there that wants to come over. I forgot the exact terminology, but it's something about they're given 90 days. They have 90 days to prove themselves, and at the end, they have a full day of skills, nonstop, different skill sets that must be met. And then once they complete it, all right, you're in. I love the fact that organizations are doing that, because if you're on a rescue, like, rescue is the jack of all trades, essentially. You have to know everything. There is no ifs, ands, or buts. You're going to know all the disciplines. So with that said, how do you build, for those that are maybe trying to do the same, how do you build a good company culture that 11's had?
So it all starts with the people you have on board with you. And sometimes, you got to get the right people on the bus and the right people off the bus. You know what I mean? You ever heard that sports analogy? I don't remember who came up with it. Number one is you got to find people you can trust. Team players that are unselfish, that are not into excuses, that don't throw pity parties. You need people that are into the job, right? It's more than just a 24-hour job. You need to have that love for it where you're going to invest in it on your time off. It just takes, that's what it takes to learn all these skills, whether you're just in firefighting or on the rescue side. You need to have that love for the job to really invest yourself in it. You have to be capable of learning that stuff. Not everybody is meant to do all the jobs in the fire service. We have some people in the fire service that I don't know why they're in it at all, whether capability wise or motivation wise. You have to be physically fit. That has to be something that's ingrained in you. If you have to be constantly pushed to stay in shape, you're probably in the wrong place, or you need to do some soul searching or get a coach or something. But you need to be physically fit. And then, personally, myself, I like people who are family oriented without a lot of drama, And there are really fun people to work with, and they're highly motivated and everything, but they can be a lot of drama too. And that can be, it's a plus and a minus for a company. But to build a culture, so you have the right players, right, that have those key qualities. And then it's the officer's job, whether it's a single company house or a double company house, it is the officer's job, like I said before, to provide the atmosphere to where that can grow, right? You want to have that atmosphere where nobody is shamed for being motivated. You want it the opposite. It's hard to be the most motivated guy in the room, right? Because there is always, you want some, you need that level of competition, whether it's in your company, within your house, you know, competing with the other shifts, to some level of competition with the companies around you. You need that level of competing. Traditions, start traditions. Research the history of your department and know where your culture comes from and draw from that. You know, take pride in where you came from. Whether your department was started in the 2000s or was started, you know, in the 1800s, like San Antonio, know where you came from. Know what your heritage is. Draw from that. If you're a special unit like a rescue company, you should definitely know, when did your team start? Who were the original players? How was it when they started? How has your equipment evolved? How was your tactics involved? Just taking pride in your family tree, you know, I think brings a lot. The traditions of the fire service in general, you know, make your firehouse look like a firehouse. We have too many fire stations in this country, and they look like dentist office. I'm not an architect. I'm not an architect, and I know, you know, in the field, we don't always get to choose what our, you know, our municipalities build for us. But you have some control over the inside, you know. If you came to Fours, it's plastered wall to wall with pictures of fires, historical pictures of steam engines, some pretty funny pictures of just guys over the years, you know, afros in the 70s and just crazy stuff. The house captain there, Dave, he's real good about the decorating of the house for purpose. You know, if you come in to the front of the station, right there on the wall, painted right on the wall in the cinder block, is the key things we expect out of each other, you know, as a crew, our expectations. On my locker door out in the bay, there's a standpipe prop right next to it. And right on the door, there's the steps painted on to dress out a standpipe, because we have a lot of high rises downtown. Things like that, you know, there's a door prop. We're very fortunate. We have a very famous fire service artist. I guarantee you've seen his work. I won't out him here on Facebook. But if you've seen anything with skeletons floating around that everybody loves, because his drawings are very detailed and really get the fire service culture, yeah, he works with us. So he's blessed us with some great artwork around the station. And it's not just the visuals, right? It's the meanings that go behind it. You personalize it, you make it your home. And I think that helps provide that atmosphere, you know, and it goes so far as to the apparatus, right? We wash our engine. We call them motors in San Antonio still. It goes way back to the days of when we modernized from steam engines to motorized apparatus. San Antonio will still call a pumper, you know, a motor. So we wash the motor every shift. Unless it's raining. If it's not actively raining, at least on my shift, because that engine is probably the most visible one in San Antonio, being downtown and being very busy, you know, we have a lot of tourism downtown. We take care of it. It's a point of pride. So even though it's not new by any means and she's pretty beat up, we clean her every shift. And I know you do too. I see your stuff. You're always cleaning your rigs and making them look spotless, ready to go. We try to do that too. Ours don't look as good as yours, but they got a little wear and tear. But it's a point of pride, right? You wash your engine every shift. You pack your hoses and make sure, you know, they're good to go. You check them every shift. You go through your compartments and your tools are, you know, cleaned and taped, and everything is where it should be. You know, everything is organized, not just tossed in a pile. Even your workout equipment, you have like an organ. We have to work out in the bay. We don't have any room in our station. Our station's tiny. but having an organized area to work out. We built a nice little sitting area out in the bay, you know. I know some people lose their mind about couches out in the
I
bay.
know.
Whatever.
Yes.
Whatever. Out of all the things that we worry about these days, it's couches in the bay.
Yeah.
But we have, you know, we have a sitting area out there. And it all of those pieces just go together, right? I know my crew, we're together for 24 hours. Nobody goes off and hides. If somebody disappears for more than 10 minutes, like three other people are going to look for them. Like, hey, what's up? You don't want to hang out? Come hang out. But having places like that, like out in the bay, when the weather's not ridiculously hot down here in Texas, we're out there in the bay, and just being out there in the bay, hanging out, leads to other things. Like, hey, let's go pull that tool out and train on it. Hey, let's stretch this line. Hey, let's just get on the engine and go drive around and see what's up and try to find something to get into, you know? But you can only do that if you're together. And if your firehouse does not support you being together, you know, if it's built to encourage you being separate, the company officer has a much tougher road, you know, to try to build that culture. So, my
No.
thoughts on that.
No, those are all facts. I mean, yes, for sure. Fire houses, not stations. Tradition, history, all important. And I think, in my opinion, I think it helps if the leadership understands that. So then as that trickles down, then the company officer should understand it. But unfortunately, there are organizations where leadership doesn't. They're disconnected, or they forget whatever the case may be. And so it makes it hard if the company tries to push something and administration catches wind, or they come by and they look at it and see it and they're like, no, get it out of here. That just deters the whole crew continuity thing.
Yeah, I'm sure that could be very demoralizing. I've been very, very blessed. My chain of command, since I've gotten to fours, has been just super supportive of me. You know, I thought in some areas it was going to be a lot harder than it is. And nothing's perfect, right? Nor is. We have plenty of our own frustrations up and down the chain. I'm sure administration's got frustrations all their own. I think you need to put yourself in other people's shoes. But I could see how them coming down and like you have a great idea and just somebody out of nowhere just squashes it without a good reason. Yeah, that'd be very frustrating. Luckily for me, I can say that I've been lucky enough not to have a lot of that, you know. My battalion chief is great. He calls me up, Rich, what do you need? That's it. I don't know, Chief, shouldn't it be the other way around? What do you need? And you're like, oh, no, you guys good? Yeah, we're good. And he's like, all right, we'll just keep doing what you're doing. Shift commander is the same way, you know. He's always willing to listen, you know, even when I disagree with some things. Like we're a single company house, right? We have an engine, four people, and we were pushing 5,000 runs last year. And us and a couple other engines were single company engines were really busy. And the administration looked at that and was like, look, you can't have your busiest companies out all the time because you what if a fire comes in, right? They can't always be busy on other runs. There's not all busyness is good. You know, you can be too busy where it's the detriment of the people you're serving. So there are some areas in the city that are like that. So they gave us two more positions this year, each shift, and they gave us a pickup truck. They call it a squad, and depending on where you are in the country, squads mean different things. But here it's a two-person manpower unit. And they have packs and they have gear. So they gave us that. That just started here in July. And so that takes some of the minor medical runs off of the engine, you know, and it's going to bring our run numbers down to manageable levels to allow us to have more time to do training or PT or whatever else we got going on, you know. But when that came out, there came out a policy to go with it. And you know how first run policies are. You always read them and you're like, what? So the person that wrote it, you know, whoever wrote it, the people they put together, in their world, in their office, or wherever they wrote it, it probably seemed very logical. And of course, when it gets to the field, to the people who are, where the rubber meets the road, they have their own version of how things should go. But so I had some things that I had an issue with, but we have a culture to where I was able to, write an email and send it up the chain. Like, hey, I take issue with this one part. I won't get into the whole policy, but there's one part that I think, needs to be revised or should be looked at. And I'm sure in some organizations that would just get tossed right in the trash. Some organizations you might get a knock on the door with, hey, who do you think you are? Da 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 da. But I didn't get that. It took a little bit, but I got an email back, and it had been forwarded up the chain to the right people and around, and it wasn't an immediate answer what I was looking for, but I definitely felt like, we were heard. And we'll see when the policy comes out. Everything gets revised every so often. We'll see if that changes down the road. But to get something like that, it felt good for me and for the company to know that we do have a voice, in the direction that things go. Will things change? Maybe, maybe not. There's only so much you have control over, especially at the company level. But yeah, so my chain of command has been really good for me personally. I'm sure there's places where guys would have complete opposite stories, depending on their
Oh.
point of view or the experience they've had. And I totally get that. I'm just expressing my gratitude. Like I've been pretty fortunate. So.
Yeah. No, I totally get it, and I wish we had more of that because, you put most organizations hopefully put the right people in the right positions, right? So when something doesn't make sense or needs more clarification or needs to be re-edited, this is where I feel like, as a fire service and the entire world in general, but especially when it comes to the fire service, we can't have those conversations without it looking at as a threat or, okay, this individual is a troublemaker. Because, like, I've had discussions with others who simply just because they ask a question, and they may or may not be the same rank, it's looked at differently, like you're undermining them. And it's like, listen, you put, like, especially when it comes to like administration, I want anybody in administration to think about this. You put individuals in charge of, you put a captain in charge of a multi-million dollar firehouse, right? And then you have personnel under that officer. You put individuals behind the wheel of multi-million dollar apparatus. Why can't they ask a question? Granted, and I will say, so I will stick up where I say it has to be done tactfully. You can't just like belittle, berate. You have to do it in a professional manner. But it seems like when you ask a question, hey, have you thought about this? Or why was this done this way? It's automatically shut down, threat. Move this person, like we can't have conversations.
There's no place for that in the fire service, and I know it happens, and it will continue to happen. But for somebody that's in that position, look what it does to your organization. If you're shutting down people that are bringing you things, look at your organization. I guarantee you there are holes that could be fixed. Or I hate it when I hear about morale problems, but then nobody wants to listen to each other. And how it goes when it comes down from on high. Why is morale not good? Like, well, what are you doing to support morale? I don't think. Here's how I, here's some how I understand the fire service. After my time in, the taxpayers, they pay the bills. Your administration will set the rules for the organization, but the culture and the morale of the department, that's 100% on the members. They drive the culture, they drive the morale. That needs to be supported by the upper echelons. There's no way they can legislate down to you good morale. I mean, they can give you brand new shiny fire trucks, tillers, whatever. And if your guys are grouchy, then they're going to be grouchy and shiny fire trucks. If they've got terrible morale and are disappointed in your SOPs or your general fire ground tactics, then more pay won't fix that. That same low morale is going to be there. So a lot of it too is we have to appreciate, number one, we have to appreciate our job. And I know I'm only going to speak for myself because I know there's a million different variations of the fire service across the country. How I look at it is this: I get paid to go to work every third day for one of the largest cities in the United States, and they give me a $1 million fire truck and four of my best friends, three of my best friends, to ride on that thing and just go flying through downtown, going to emergencies. A lot of them are, subacute emergencies, but some of them are big ones.
Right.
And we have fun every shift, and you have to appreciate, to do that. Every department has its struggles, and some good friends of mine are very frustrated with our department and have been for some time. And I get that. But for me personally, coming from where I came from, I'll always be very grateful to this city for giving me the opportunity to live my dream. And some people will call you a company man for that or whatever. And okay, if me being grateful for being allowed to live my dream makes me a company man, then I am. And I am a company man. I'm for my company 100%. But I think your happiness starts there. You got to appreciate being able to do the job. I don't think anybody's ever ashamed to say that they're a firefighter, right? When somebody asks you what you do, as time goes early in your career, you can't wait to tell everyone. And then later on, you don't want to tell everyone. But when they finally pull it out of you, nobody's ever embarrassed to say they're a firefighter. We're all proud of it. And that came from 150 years plus of other people doing the right thing, like you don't own that pride. That came from those that came before us. I think when you acknowledge that and you're grateful for your job, you're grateful for the amazing people you get to work with, and their families, right? Even outside of work. Once you have that gratitude, you can be happier in the job no matter what's going on. And hopefully your administration will support you. I know some will and some won't. But you can't let, your administration dictate your happiness in life.
Right. Especially with you being a company officer, I'm sure you've told your crew and yourself, hey, when we're inside these four walls, we're going to worry about us. We're not going to worry about what admin is doing. Because I'm sure with an organization as large as yours, it's not like you guys have to worry about the fire chief showing up. Like that just doesn't happen unless something terrible happens. Most of the time, it's hey, we're here, we're going to work, let's have a good day.
100%. It's like you've been there before. That's exactly how we feel. And it's been that way, my whole time as a company officer, including like the dark days of COVID, that was rough on anybody. Anybody who was a company officer during COVID, like my hat's off to you. That was what a tough time. The policies were confusing. Everyone's trying to get it right. The information is always conflicting. And it would just be, everyone would get frustrated to the point of this, like, oh man, this is nonsense. But then somebody would die, and then you're like, oh my gosh. So, but during those times when morale was really tough, that's what we did, at least at my house. We insulated ourselves, like, look, I know everything outside of this station is chaos. And we had a lot of stuff going on. There was, a lot of civil unrest at the same time. We had a really bad freeze down here, which was very rare for South Texas, where the infrastructure got trashed, pipes bursting everywhere. There was a lot of crazy stuff going on. But I was like inside this house, like, man, we all love each other. We're all on the same page. We're just going to help each other get through this. And whatever happens outside of here happens outside of here. And the same, even after COVID, when things happen now in the department or, you know, or in the fire service, guys start to get really spun up about it. I'm like, look, let's just sit down and think about it. How does this really affect us on a day-to-day basis? Like, we know what this policy says or what happened over here, but how is this going to affect us today? They're like, oh, well, I guess it really doesn't. I'm like, okay, it really doesn't. Like, we acknowledge what this is outside of here, but let's not let it ruin our, you know, our joy for the job, because it's not going to change our day to day. We all need reminding of that sometimes, you know.
Definitely.
Sometimes just what is what is. And, you know, in your house, it either affects you on a day to day or it doesn't. So.
Perfect. Okay, love it. When it comes to the fire service, in your opinion, where do you see that we're doing good with, like improving, or no, I'm sorry. Where do you see that the fire service can improve on, and where do you see that we're making strides when it comes to recruitment and retention?
I think one thing in general, and I'll just speak for myself in my area, is getting back to the basics of firemanship is somewhere we can still improve. I tell my crew, even though they're getting to be a lot younger than me these days, did you watch the first Top Gun movie?
I did.
Okay. You remember when they go to Top Gun and the teacher's like, hey, here's why Top Gun was created. You know, in Korea, our kill ratio was like 12 to run, 12 to 1. The guys were really great at dogfighting and their basic skills. They get to Vietnam, they're relying on missiles that aren't that great. Their kill ratio drops, they're losing their basic skills. They create Top Gun to get their basic skills back, right? They're dogfighting. I feel like in the fire service, we're doing the same thing. When I came in, the mantra was, pump at 150, bake at 350. Everything that I knew coming in was automatic, you know, electronic fire ground commanders. When you push a preset, that's your pressure. You know, you had a huge fog nozzle on the end that no matter what you pumped it at, the stream looked pretty, you know. Those were your missiles, quote unquote. Everything had an easy button, right? Which worked until it didn't. And when it didn't, it got us in a lot of trouble. We didn't always realize why. And now we're going back to the basics, back to the pre-technology area. You see a lot of engines and ladders, I guess, across this country. You look at the apparatus specs, and in the places that I feel are doing it right, they're going right back to what we did before. It's more modern, but those hose beds are starting to come back down to a reasonable level. The crazy, super complicated hose loads are going back to the simple flat load or Minuteman. You know, our nozzles have gone from these fog nozzles, which, if you have one particular company, are so big that they need two pistol grips and a bipod on it. Now they're coming back down to a simple little shut off with a smoothbore tip, or, you know, a fog with a fixed flow where you can tell if you're being underpumped, you know? So. This we're in our Top Gun era of getting our dogfighting skills back. That's where I think the fire service is, at least from my view. As far as recruiting and retention, man, we recruit who we can get, right? When I was trying to get in, everyone was trying to get in. And then after September 11th, there was that huge surge of patriotism in firefighters being, you know, elevated in stature. And that was something that a lot of people aspired to. And of course, I think we've seen that all kind of wane over the years. And a lot of the glory has been, the shine has come off the job somewhat. And now we're coming into an era of financial struggle for a lot of people across the country. Finances have not been great, you know, the economy. So now people are starting to come back to the job, but the job force looks a lot different. So we need to be recruiting people that want to do the job. I don't think you recruit that. I'm just going to speak for myself on this. You can't recruit for this job based on the benefits. If you're coming here to make a living, I understand that 100%. We all need to put food on the table for our families. But if that's the only reason you're here and you're not going to really try to earn that, we don't need you. You need to come here with the understanding that this is still a blue collar job. It's hard work. There's the danger of injury, death, disease, that's all a part of it. Now we're more aware of mental health. Yes, that's going to play into it. Do I think this will be a little bit controversial? Do I think we sometimes overemphasize the negative aspects of the job? I think we do, in an effort to get to raise awareness, but that reaches everywhere. If we post a lot about those things and have a lot to say about them, it will raise awareness, but that will affect your recruiting too. So it's a fine line of, hey, these are some risks for the job. They're very real risks. And then it goes so far as to be, paranoia to where we can drive people away from the job before they ever give it a shot, So we need to recruit people whose heart is in the right place, whose abilities are what we need to help us on the job, move forward without scaring them off with the negative aspects. We need to paint them a very real picture of it. And then support them. If you tell somebody who's undersized in the traditional sense that they can do this job, well, by God, when you put them on the job, you better give them an apparatus and a hose line and an equipment and gear that fits them to support them doing the job that you just told them that they'll be able to do. If they're going to give everything they have, you need to support them. So that's how I think we would go with retention.
Love it. Love it. Okay. I always like to ask the guest before, I always like to ask the guest this last question. Where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
I think I'm already there.
Really?
I
Then no
listen.
more.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I never say never. I mean, I'm at 24 years in the fire department. I'm going to go to at least 30. My kids just started freshman year in high school, so they're probably going to want to go to college. They are both already been out to A&M and they love it. So I might be here a lot longer than that. I don't know. But every year at the end of the year, I like to sit down with my crew. I love them to death. I work with the best people. And we go through it. Hey, how did we do this year? What can I do different? What can I do better? What are your goals for this year? And for the first time this past year, it was I got asked the same question back. One of my crew members, she was like, "Well, I'll tell you, listen to ours. What are your goals this year?" And without even thinking about it, I guess it was just a throwaway answer. I said, "Your goals are my goals." But then, I thought about it on my ride home, which I always replay my entire shift on my ride home. I live about 40 miles from my firehouse. I live out in the country, so it's a peaceful ride home. And I don't know. I was thinking about that, like, why did I say that? And then I thought about it. It's like I've already accomplished more than I thought I ever would in the fire service. And part of it was because I never really had a plan. I was the guy that was just happy to be here. But I look at it now and I'm already in the spot I want to be in. I have no aspirations to make chief. I really don't want to leave the firehouse I'm at. I can't think of a better place to come to work. I work with the best people. I love our scenery. We have everything from high rises to old 2.5-story balloon frames. We have basements. We have a river. We got highway. We got rail. I mean, there's anything you could ever want. We don't do the most fire in the city compared to some. Most of your fires are residential, right? And we don't have a ton of residential. We have a lot of downtown. But the fire, we do get our fair share. We really do. Especially the A shift this year. They're killing it. We had it last year. This year it's the A shift. But we get every shift I come to work and I check my BA, I have the reasonable expectation that I'm going to put it on for a fire that day. And I feel very lucky to have that. Will we get a fire every shift? No. Is there the reasonable expectation every day that I go to work? Yeah, there is. So I don't know how you can beat that. So because I'm so happy with where I am, and trying to help move my department forward, in whatever aspect I can, or assist other people, then it's I'm good, right? I'm good. But what does my crew need? I get these amazing people that come in that put their trust in me, to help them move their career forward and look after them while they do it. So what do they want? I have whatever they want to do. That's my goal. Help them get to where they want to be, and have as much fun as we possibly can along the way. Like I love coming to work every shift. I can't even remember the last time I had a bad day at work, So that's what I want. That's what I want to do for the rest of the time that God willing that I can be in the fire service, as long as I can stay healthy, stay fit, keep up with these guys, that's what I want to do. I want to be here trying to take them to as many fires as possible, to as many crazy incidents as downtown will give us, and see them through it, safely, I hope. And then, and then they'll move on to their next thing. And it's always heartbreaking when somebody leaves your crew that you really love, but at the same time, you're super proud of them because they always go on, to do something amazing and, make you proud. I lost four guys in the span of 2 years to the rescue company down the street, because we're in close proximity to them. We want the same things out of our people because I learned everything from that place, about how to run a company. So of course they're going to start recruiting your members away from you. And what are you going to say? Don't go. You're like, well, they're like, LT, you got all these great stories from there. Should I go? No, but yeah, you should go. You should go. Or they promote, or, they just do something else that'll amaze you, and you get to watch their career grow. And yeah, that's where I see myself, for the next 6, 7 years, whatever it's going to be, whatever God will allow me to do.
Okay. And obviously, whether you know it or not, you are making an impact because, and I told you this when I spontaneously called you, but one of your firefighters was like, hey man, I get an email and I read it. And it's like, hey man, first off, I listen to your podcast. I love the message. Thank you for what you're doing. If you ever want another guest, this is Rich Anderson. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, I typed back or I wrote back an email. Hey, who's Rich? And he was like, he's my company officer. He has no idea I'm doing this, but I just want to know if you'd reach out. And I was like, hell yeah, absolutely. So obviously, Ryan Hicks, thank you for putting me in contact with your LT. And LT, obviously, what you are doing, what you have done, what you've seen through your experiences, the mentorship, the friendships, you are making a difference because one of your firefighters recommended you. So obviously, continue what you're doing. Yeah, I mean, nothing else needs to be said. You are leading by example.
I really appreciate that, Danny. I don't know what to say. Thank you. I guess I'll just say thank you to Ryan. Thanks, brother. Danny, I appreciate what you're doing. I love your show. I love how you do it. I love how you just let the conversation just go where it needs to go without, trying to dominate it or try to force it in a direction. You just kind of let it be. And, for somebody like me who I really don't get out of my circle much, you have everybody from somebody like me who's kind of down in the weeds to all the big names, that really have the big ideas and the big messages to share, and the really profound careers that we all love to listen to. Anyways, thank you. Thank you for what you do. I appreciate it.
No, man. And listen, you mentioned one thing, which is what I want other people to understand. Like, don't get me wrong, I love the big hitters. Love them.
Sure.
I'll never get to experience what most of them do because a lot of them work for large organizations such as yours with the amount of personnel, big metropolitan cities. So, there was a time where I thought to myself, like, okay, I have the title of firefighter, but man, I'm not really a firefighter. I work for a little town in North Carolina. right next door to the largest fire department in North Carolina. Like, I'm not a fireman, but through my experiences, I was fortunate to work when I worked part-time. I worked at an organization that had a lot of Charlotte firefighters, right? And with every organization, you have those who are just like, I'm just gonna be blunt, dicks. Like, they carry themselves, oh, if you're not this, you're nothing, blah, blah, blah. And then the great thing about that organization was they hired a good number of down-to-earth firefighters. And they're like, oh, where do you work at? Oh, okay, you work for Mooresville? Cool. Yeah, I know where that is. I've heard about it, blah, blah, blah. Hey, man, listen, what you're going through, we go through. Okay. And we're talking like 40, I think they're like 45, 44 stations, something like that. You know, the personnel, the amount of fires, they're like, hey, man, it's all the same thing. And that's the thing, it's perspective. They said, one sat me down and he was like, listen, we got crews that go to a bunch of fires. We got crews that are after. We got crews that are doing it. But then we also have crews and people that are hiding behind the fact that they're Charlotte firemen. Okay. They're like, it's not about the brand, the name of the organization. We're all in the same atmosphere. It's just different scales. And so what I'm trying to get at is if people can understand that the fire service, we're all doing the same job, just in a different quantity over quality. You know what I mean? So like I used to kind of feel like, man, yeah, I'm a fireman, but I work for whatever. And it's like, you know, you kind of like, you just kind of feel like ashamed. And it's like, no, don't feel ashamed about your organization. Whatever you
No.
work for, be the best damn fireman that you can be, because the people who call 911 don't give a damn if it's Charlotte Fire Department, FDNY, San Antonio, Houston, Miami. They need help and they need professionals to come, because that's what we give. We give off that vibe. Hey, you need help, fire department's here. We're gonna show up and we're gonna do the job day in and day out. So I love the fact that I get to talk to big names. I get to talk to individuals like Rich Anderson. I get to talk to people that work for fire departments where there's two men on a truck and they're doing what they gotta do. So like, don't ever put yourself on other people's pedestals. Live your life, but try to live it properly. And I just thank you for the conversation that we've had today. I appreciate Ryan Hicks for mentioning you. I appreciate him even listening to little old me, because I'm a nobody. I am a guy that hides. I'm
Not
behind a
anymore.
mic. I'm behind a microphone, and we talk shop. While they're up to me, the people that are really making the differences are the instructors, are the people teaching classes, outside training. Those are the real people, because they're the ones that got me to where I'm at today to be able to do this. So I just wanted to say that.
We all, brother, I was as guilty as anybody when I got on the job, and I thought I was hot stuff, big city fireman. I didn't want to listen to anybody, you know. And throughout your career, if you're like that, you'll be like me and you'll get humbled over and over again, and it's embarrassing. And then you got to grow through that and not do that anymore. And then over time, you realize exactly what you said. And I think the internet has helped a lot with that, where you can look out there and you can see who the real players are, you know. And it doesn't matter what name is on their, you know, on their lid. It doesn't matter. You can tell who's into the job and getting after it. And who's not. You can tell who the pretenders are, you know, even if they come with a really slick advertising package, you know who's for real and who's not after a while. Department really, you know, where you work doesn't have a whole lot to do with it anymore. I think that's the really cool thing about the age of firefighting that we're in. It almost goes back all the way to the beginning. If you look at old pictures from the turn of the last century, nobody's name was on their coat, nobody's name was on their helmet. There was just a company number, and we all had similar gear. The apparatus all looked the same. I mean, if you could tell one city's horses from another, then, you know, good on you. But our roots all come back to the same place. If you look at an old picture of LA versus a picture of Boston versus, you know, a horse-drawn steamer from or Charlotte or Houston, San Antonio, wherever, you're probably not going to be telling the difference, you know, unless you know the area in the background. And I think in a weird way, we're coming back to that. It's just coming back to people who are about the job. And even though we're a big city, my crew goes out and they get trained by the best in the business who are not in San Antonio. I mean, just in the past year, my least senior firefighter, she's been out training with Aaron Fields. She's been out with brothers in battle with Cody Trestrail. She was out training. She and Ryan were out there stretching lines with, my fire service idol, which is Timmy Klett. I kind of want to model my career after his. I steal a lot of his tactics, his thought processes, so we all have a big brother, even if they don't know they're our big brother. We all have people to learn from, and all the ego stuff just needs to go away.
Absolutely. But it's a cycle. You know what I mean? Like, I talked to I call them old heads, OGs back in the day, and they're like, low hose beds, we had those. And then as people started designing apparatus, that became an afterthought. And so your hose beds were high. But nothing that we're seeing today is really essentially new. It's new to us because we weren't around back in the day to see that.
Comes right out of the Bible, my brother. Nothing is new under the sun.
Well, Rich, I appreciate it, man. I loved hearing your story. Like I said, continue being you. I just want to say thank you for coming on, man, and talking shop and sharing your story for others to hear. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity, brother. Keep doing what you're doing.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.